Okay, welcome to Section 5, where probably Project 2 is still on your minds, I'm guessing. And I apologize for not having as much time as anticipated for the XSL FO. Namespaces were way more exciting than I expected they would be. So I'm happy to field any and all questions on XSL FO, and certainly anything related to the project as well. So I'll open the floor. Yeah. Okay, namespace question. Okay. So good question. If you have two different XSL files, hopefully both of their elements are associated with the same XSL namespace. Otherwise, you just have a functionality problem in the beginning. It is not necessary for each of them to use the same XSL prefix. One could use David colon, one could use XSL colon, so long as those two prefixes are both bound to the correct namespace. Zaylin, for instance, won't have a problem with it. So really, the issue of namespaces is almost irrelevant. So long as both documents are correctly written XSLT, there's no worries, really. If, however, you used include, which gives the included stuff the same priority as the current stuff, actually not even, include or import. If you defined in one file a prefix and then in the other file defined the same prefix but with a different element in a different scope, let's see if this is problematic. That could create a problem because if you defined a prefix, it wouldn't create a problem, it would shadow it. So what would happen is if in the root element of document 1, you defined a David prefix. In the root element of document 2, you defined a David prefix. And you, in document 1, did an XSL include of that file. The David prefix from the second XSL file would be included at that point in the file as a child or wherever of the root element in document 1. So essentially that prefix would now shadow the original one. So again, no problem, but potential serious confusion if you're trying to use the same prefix in both places. Good question. Yeah?
It occurs to me, when we're drawing these lines between the stations,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's got to be some instances where you've got two lines going between the two stations.
Two lines going between the two stations, sure.
Some lines going to win out.
Yeah, the question is when you have, for instance, you have certain stations are on both lines, like the circle and district line have a huge overlapping subset of stations. What we've done and seen in the past is whichever color wins is fine. One can lay on top of the other. If you enjoy the work and want to spend time doing slight offsets, by all means, go for it. Or do some kind of amalgam of the colors where you combine them somehow to create a brown or whatever. So really, however you want to handle it, but this is more about XSLT and SVG than it is about beauty. So don't fret that sort of the detail.
Well, yeah, if you wind up doing an offset for the two parallel lines, then is it okay if then the whole line is offset by some small amount of y, then it won't really be exactly geographically correct.
Correct. So if you use an offset, it won't necessarily be geographically correct. We had the same exact problem when I was implementing that visualization of the strength of the sensor network nodes. So frankly, the solution I deployed was I made my circles bigger so that they would still hit the circles, and that was sort of a reasonable approach. I mean, they're not huge, but large enough so that I had a few pixels leeway where it still looked reasonable as though one line were going into another circle. If you're doing offsets, though, you will need to use trigonometry because it's not as simple as just incrementing the Y offsets and going like this, because if your two stations are like this, you offset them this way, it doesn't do anything. You could do it diagonally, but then if the two stations are like this and you offset it diagonally, you can always find a situation, unless you're doing things functionally, where there is no effect of your shifting because you just shift it on top of the original line.
I think even detecting these collisions programmatically in XSL is going to be difficult.
It's doable. It might be more expensive than it's worth, certainly. Because you could certainly check for such intersection or count the number of nodes that actually intersect and the number of lines that intersect at the station. I wouldn't fret about this until the very end if you enjoy playing with these details. Sure. Okay, do you need different symbols for interchanges? No, it's not specified. If you want to, by all means, go ahead. The spec, I mean, I intentionally left the spec fairly loose with its requirements so that you can actually have design fun with it, just so that there's a minimal subset of functionality supported by everyone. So if there's nothing in the spec that would contradict what you want to do, then go for it. The more interesting, the better. Sure, keep them coming.
So I was thinking about how to make the maps, but I thought of some kind of inefficient ways to do it.
Okay.
Can you give me some suggestions to think of an efficient way to do it?
Efficient ways to do the map.
The map. Well, just because, like, say, in the circle example, we have the group. So we have a line, say, like a circle line, and we have a group of the lines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it seems like in order to make that output, you would have to kind of go over and over the XML document a lot of times.
Yeah, the short answer is that I think for our purposes, the best approach is to do the most straightforward one first, which is probably to iterate over the lines and determine what physical lines you need to actually draw, thereafter iterating perhaps over the stations themselves, and then overlaying on top of everything the circles, so that the circles actually don't fall under. If you have the circles underneath the lines, the map will look weird and confusing, I think, to read, but if you overlay your black circles on top of everything, that alone can help help make clear how everything's intersecting. The question about efficiency is actually intentionally left for that second to last question in the spec, which is how could you lay out the data set better to lend itself to greater efficiency? The data is designed currently to be efficient in its storage. There's very little redundant information. But that does not lend itself to efficient processing. Arguably, that's perfectly reasonable given that London does not often add data to its tube or trams or trains. You can make an argument if a station goes down, you might like to regenerate these maps. But again, probably very reasonable in a real-world sense that if it takes even 10 minutes to generate the map, well, that's fine because you're doing it once. 10 minutes is more processing time than is necessary for this project. But I would say that the kinds of questions you're asking yourself are good, but frame them in the context of that last question. What would you do differently from the get-go rather than dealing with the data as is? Right, how could you massage it into something that might be less storage efficient but much more time efficient?
It seems like the right way to go about this kind of a problem is in the beginning you want to make it very efficient, one because of the computer, but two because of the poor person that's implementing the data. You don't have to put it in 5 different ways from Sunday.
Right.
Then you want to pass it through some kind of a filter, if you're interested in speed, that is,
mm-hmm.
which then duplicates the heck out of it, but at the same time makes it really efficient for something like this.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, same is true in database design. Like, you don't want there to be redundant data in your database in principle, but often that makes it a huge pain executing queries against it unless you sort of pre-process the data. So, again, that's what that last question is really meant to get at.
Question 8.
Okay. What was that one?
Lot of coordinates in the formula x by 400 plus 1.
Okay.
Do we need to implement all those?
The coordinates. You don't need the coordinates themselves so much as you need them relatively. So I believe the spec requires that you somehow incorporate links to the GIFs that we provide. And the GIF coordinates are useful for that so that you know, one, what GIF to display. I mean, I imagine maybe a student generating a little JavaScript window that pops up a little window and shows you a square for that current map. You can be more elegant using some CSS and JavaScript and actually show it inline, for instance, somewhere in the page. Or you could, it would probably be quite ugly to just drop all of the squares in one page because it would be huge and then just do a hyper-reference, fragment ID type reference. So the short of it is that... Well, you're talking about if you're putting all the images in the current page, it just gets, it's doable. It's just, I guess you didn't lay them all out together, did you?
Well, there's just references to the JIT files.
But then do you lay them out just vertically or do you lay them out in a table?
Vertically.
Oh, so that's reasonable. But scrolling 2,800 pixels left-right is probably a nuisance.
You just click on it and throw it down, but you don't even know where it is, and you have a little back.
That's fine.
Table there and a lot back, and it looks just as good.
Yep, that's fine. That, I think, would be to lay it out with an invisible table going this way, horizontally, because there's no way to hyper-reference horizontally in a browser. So the short answer is however you want, for the most part. I mean, there's very few sentences that specify what you must include, and I think the sentence relevant here is that for the geographic coordinates, you need to somehow include a link to the streetmap.co.uk site, interpret as you will. And then you need to, for the graphic, somehow link to the appropriate square. So you won't be outputting, most likely, the literal coordinates except to include them as, like, here, the I'm on, what page is this? Page 17 of the spec. You would include them as the reference here. As the value of the input variables. And realize, too, I mean, some of the fun, sort of nuisance, annoying little details you may trip over is dealing with something as simple as this, like this ampersand, will likely break your code the first time you try to output it. So bear things like that in mind. That's part of the experience. If you're wondering why, you go back a few lectures and think on that. Silly little details like that, but worth reinforcing. Did that answer your question? This map with the floor, yeah, you will, effectively, in order to figure out what square to show the user.
Oh.
Right? The reason I define it mathematically is so that you know from the GIF-based coordinates which map, which square you should use. And the squares are defined in terms of the sections of the map they're taken from. Yep, right. Like when you have the GIF coordinates, you plug it into this formula, it tells you what file name to output there or what file to link to there. But there's probably no reason to ever output in the file the literal 2189, comma, whatever, for the pixel that's way over here, or rather, way over here. Or there. There. Good questions. And again, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised in the end how relatively little code you need to write to implement this. More of it is about the design and thinking about how you get the data, not how much time, how many lines of code it takes to output the data. Yeah?
Just looking at the source of that sample SVG tube map.
Okay. Which of these were you looking at?
Which is it? G2 map. Yeah, that's...
Oh, yes. This was done in by someone else in Illustrator. And these curves might have been... I don't know how the fellow did this one. It might have been done partly by hand, frankly, or the curves might have been interpolated, but frankly, I'm suspicious because you see very different types of curves throughout the file, which suggests to me more human intervention. You're welcome to do that, and I think it would be neat to ever so slightly curve some of the lines rather than have the straight lines, but then again, it's not necessary. So, but then again, it's not hard to swap out a line element for a or you know a path element. Wouldn't be hard to experiment, that is to say. Sure. But but look more closely at some of the parameterization of the paths as to how many parameters you actually need to provide to just give it some form of arc. So.
I've done similar things with this with using Java, but
It's tough, though, because you'd probably want to take into account previous stations, right? Because the circle district line goes like this, but if you take two nodes in isolation, how do you know it doesn't go this way versus that way? So. I mean, that's what you could do in groups of three stations, right? Use the middle point as the thing you asymptote toward, and you, frankly, make the circle big enough so that you actually hit the circle, but you get a curve out of it.
Yeah, there's like for each pair or for each segment, for like each two, you know, like for each segment in between stations, you need like four parameters. So you need like the start, the end, even though there's two.
And looking at, just so you know, there are a few good references here on the site for SVG, more than you're probably going to want to spend time looking at, but several of these are good little tutorials that will probably even give you more than you need, but again, this too, SVG reference with examples to show you what you can do and how. So feel free to poke through some of those. But again, a lot of it, I mean, frankly, we teach it by example just because certainly what we want to get across is instructive alone through examples. Other questions? How'd my blockbuster must be done by now, yes? That was the easy one. Yeah? Okay, good. Good, good, good.
Maybe you don't want to give me the answer to it.
Okay.
But seeing you give a little hint sometimes about why things are difficult.
Okay.
One thing that I found was annoying about that problem is that there were, what was it, top level? I don't know. It was hard to iterate through because there, whenever you extrapolate, you know, an element, there's all these groups that are attached to it. And I really wanted to do, oh, I know what it was, there's a radius, right?
Okay.
You just want to say, put the R here, and everything below it, and put the TG here, and everything below it, and you want to have some top level loop that iterates through them all. But it'd be nice not to have to hard code in, you know, radius anywhere in the code.
Oh, and you don't need to.
And I'm thinking maybe recursion or something is the way around it, but is there a better way than that?
Hard coding okay?
For this, it's fine because it's reasonable to hard code G, PG, PG13, and so forth. But using different axes, you can retrieve a set of textually unique ratings. So, for instance, and without spoiling it, just because it'll be useful, I think, to tinker with it. If just to get us started, if you did / rating, that would give you all of the rating elements. And there's going to be, so far as aesthetic duplication goes, a lot of duplication. But if you want to filter out everything except one instance of G, one instance of PG, one instance of PG13, consider using something like the preceding access and using a filter that says include this rating element only if it is not equal to something called rating that preceded it in the document. So essentially, you still iterate, albeit somewhat inefficiently, over all the rating elements. But on each iteration, you look at the current element, but you also look back in document order at the tree and say, have I seen a rating element before with this value? Because consider in XPath what we mean by value. We mean the concatenation of its textual descendants. And that will allow us to also filter things out.
Okay.
Go ahead. If you wanted to sort it, you would have to do that in like your for each construct. Okay. Coincidence, yeah. You can take the advantage of that because we make no requirement of it, but be careful.
Using key function, I think you can generate unique values.
You can as well. There are more elegant approaches that I even allude to tonight, using something like XSL key or generate ID. And there's a couple examples of this, I think, on the W3 school site that would allow you to do it. A simpler way, at least one consistent with some of the stuff we've already looked at, would be the preceding access. And it's not hard. Just got to get the syntax right.
You can do the same thing recursively. You kind of tell it what you
just... Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And really, you should be leveraging the power of the language for that, not trying to re-implement it yourself. But key, I mean, frankly, the best approach is probably to leverage things like key and generate ID, because arguably the processor can do a much better job at optimizing those problems and not, I mean, the preceding access is, I mean, we're talking n squared here, running time, which is bad for large files. So key would be probably closer to something linear if it used a hash table subsequently.
We can do the same thing in a tube tool, like generate the tube by the type and the record.
Yeah, absolutely. Using these keys, and again, we do so much in just those 2 weeks of XSLT that we spend less time on some of the fancier features. But yeah, if you can pick it up, you can do more clever things with it.
Is there somewhere they're using normalized space and normalized?
Mm-hmm. So normalized space, the XPath function. So normalized space allows you to condense any multiple instances of a space into a single white space. So if you have sloppy carriage returns or new line characters in your document, or you have the space bar hit a bunch of times, normalized space will condense all such instances of white space into one atomic white space. And then there's also another one that regards leading and I think trim white space, something like that, which trims it from the front and the back, which keeps things clean as well, especially when you have human-readable XML with lots of carriage returns and indentation, but that is meaningless white space. But in the absence of a DTD, for instance, you might want to use XPath to filter that white space out if the XML parser is not going to for you. Hopefully this is getting fun, because this is meant to be a fun exercise, and it does build up in complexity, so that I really...
I thought the worst part of it was that FO.
It's my fault for it 2 sections ago not making clear which parts should compile correctly.
I haven't even touched that yet.
Oh, no, that's my fault then for not making more clear that these projects are not meant to have you teach yourself material. Like if you see some buzzword or some top or some section of the project, doesn't mean you're meant to go teach yourself. And also perhaps in the future, check the syllabus and see if those topics are maybe coming. Since we can't do everything the night that the project is released, so... And I realize we jump around in the spec where I think the spec says written flow logically well, but I realize that we only introduce material here over here, so it's a trade-off as to how they're written.
So in this first question, quickies.
Mm-hmm.
So just to create a questions got a flow file and then generate the PDF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea is essentially you can use the framework of Jabberwocky from tonight, looking over that and writing up, I mean, you would do something for questions.xml, and this is left intentionally vague just so that you can do with it what you wish. We mean to do something like this, questions, and then maybe you have a question element, and maybe you have an attribute here, number, which tells you what number question it is, and then maybe you have like a p tag, which is this is my answer, close p. I mean, that's all we're talking about in terms of wrapping it with XML markup. In questions.xsl, you would write XSLT that understands this structure and processes it. And in what you would generate from that XSL file is what we saw tonight, XSLFO, a lot of whose framework will be copy-pasted into the template, or one of your templates, the rest of which will be dynamically generated, like in jabberwocky.xsl. And again, there was a bunch of code there, but almost all of it was XSLT, with which you'd be familiar. The only new lines were like a bunch of XSLFO blocks. And for the curious and those of you that want to do aesthetically more interesting things, realize that the slides we didn't touch on tonight, there's only really a couple. Slides 37 and 38 in particular really show you more clearly how FO borrows heavily from CSS. And it tells you, if you want to do more interesting things with font and size and bold facing, italics and so forth, slides 37 and 38 plus the Jabberwocky example implicitly just show you some more aesthetic stuff, but none of which I think you'll find mind-blowing. It's all pretty straightforward.
General question.
Okay, here.
I tried to publish something, everything went fine, and but then I went to the web and tried to get there and kept trying to log in. There didn't seem to be any logging that worked. There's two. The sort of one you get with the course to sign up, and the one you get
But there was also one, and I wish there were simpler ways of, I wish there were, the school supported a way of tying all of this together more easily. When you generated, when you ran CSEIE 259 web for project one, you were prompted to choose a password, as I recall. No?
Yeah.
So you chose a password for that. Changing it, if you email me, I can tell you the command with which you can regenerate it. Actually, oh, sorry, I think you might be able to just I forget how I wrote the web script, but try just rerunning CSEIE 259 web, and hopefully it will clobber your old password. Does it? Okay, I forget how I wrote that thing, so. Oh, yep, sorry.
The
which? The FO? Okay.
All the different outputs that you make.
Okay.
Then I'll scan the background, like to do PDF or do whatever. As long as it's following this XML-like.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. The fact that we're having it uploaded as PDF is just for my own convenience, so I can view a PDF and not raw FO formatting.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the conversion is done in the back end.
The actual processing is all done by the engine.
By FOPs, in our case, yeah. Yep. It's sort of like, it's very neutral. I mean, XHTML and HTML4 try to take a step toward this notion of abstracting away the notion of formatting, like the EM tag was meant to replace italics because it generalizes the notion of what it means to emphasize something. And same with strong versus B for bold, meant to being an abstraction. So FFO is sort of similar in that.
But something also came up with coloring fonts. It seems like with the CSS model, they sort of want to apply it to things in general. But you get an assignment where we got 30 different train lines and we want to use colors for fonts. And it seems like you have to use the font element, but that's deprecated, they say. Is that?
The thing I did is just put aside actually writing an inline style sheet at the top.
Yeah. Use the style attribute.
In the part of the head,
right.
You just put a style tag and just put a CSS style sheet in there. So I just output that.
Oh, a style tag, you mean, or style attribute of like a...
It's the style sheet. I put a bunch of text at the
bottom. Oh, at the top, okay.
For every color or every line?
Well, you can use a class. There's a couple of different ways to do it. One is you can use a class for you can have a class for each one.
But you generated that, you're saying on the block, you
can actually type it. No, I typed it in the X itself. It's just a block.
Yeah, no, and honestly, this would be a great conversation to strike up on the listserv, because teaching CSS tricks, more than appropriate, if you want to share such ideas. Other questions? All right, why don't we officially adjourn here, but I'll stick around if you have individual questions.